Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. The CW is giving DC's Legends of Tomorrow a holiday. How are things for that series, Locopots, return January 24th? We'll all learn from the person responsible for that look. Director of Photography Malon Todd Williams joins me next live from Vancouver, British Columbia. Speaking of look, have you seen what Spanish language television has been up to lately? Telenovelas picking up the pace and going viral musical, weekly dramas, and historic primetime Olympics coverage for starters. You ain't seen nothing yet for 2017, according to our second guest today, Spanish TV executive and expert Cliff Stroud, and we will connect with him next half hour. Also ahead, A&E explores Generation KKK, our classic trivia question of the week, and our up statement on two Friday guests, one showing up and the other not. And for the one showing up, we have a breaking news development. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the half hour. Happy Holiday Week 2016 to you and all. 27 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York, and we are delighted to have you with us for the program All Back Television. Jam-packed hour in store for you with two wonderful guests, one from here in New York, the other coming shortly from Vancouver, Canada, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, a ring from you and your voice attached with it. Here's the number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the world, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Our chat room is open as well to get your feedback. It's SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Malon Todd Williams joins me live from Canada after these news notes. A&E will begin 2017 with an eye-opening study of people in the hood of the Ku Klux Klan. Generation KKK, set to debut January 10th, will spotlight several Klan members and their families, along with three activists out to trigger an exodus from the Klan among those members. The series was filmed over the last 18 months. A&E General Manager Rob Chernow insists the series will not be, and he says not be, a platform for KKK perspective. Shameless is on for season 8 on Showtime next year. The season was greenlit after co-star Emily Rossum reached a new contract last week. Netflix wants to launch 30 unscripted series next year. Ultimate Beastmaster, co-produced by Sylvester Stallone and the creator of The Biggest Loser, Dave Broom, will be one of the first to arrive. More than 100 competitors from the U.S., Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, Germany, and Japan will test their tenacity on extreme obstacle course. Each country has its own version of the program for Netflix, with Brooklyn Nine-Nine co-star Terry Crews and Fox Sports' Carissa Thompson doing the domestic honors. The first race debuts February 24th. And there's a Chinese connection in Simon Cowell's near future. Cowell's Psycho Entertainment Venture now has a 3-year format development pact with Canxing Productions. Whatever format emerges will launch in China first, globally second. And that's news notes for today. Now joining us live from Vancouver, British Columbia, the director of photography on DC Legends of Tomorrow, Malon Todd Williams. Malon, great to have you with us. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays. Thanks for having me, Simon.
Very welcome. It's great to have you. Malon, how has your series evolved from season 1 to 2, all in the space of a year?
The writers and producers have amped up the scripts that we've had. The last couple that I've had in particular have been some of the biggest episodes, with action and stunts that I've been able to do, from season 1, my first episode, which is 103, to we just finished 212, which was a lot of exterior stuff, but there was probably 30, 40 stunt people on most of our days.
When you're doing a program which has so much emphasis on stunt work, on action,
yep,
on computer-generated effects, and so forth, how does it impact the kind of photography, the kind of cinematography you want us to see?
Well, this show's been fantastic because not only have the producers allowed us to visually go crazy with the show, but the the fact that we time travel and we get into different time periods has been amazing. So one episode, you know, I'm in 1864, the next episode I'm in 1927. And, you know, so the look of the show is constantly changing when they leave the ship. And we're generally, you know, we're allowed to go, you know, fairly nuts with the, you know, the look of the show when it comes to those, you know, that portion of the show. When they're on the Wave Rider, there's sort of a standard look that we try to keep with that portion of it.
So when you get a script for a series like this, where do you first go? Do you go to the director? Do you go to the production designer? Do you go to other people and say, okay, this is what you're going for. How would you like me to frame the action? How would you like me to place the cameras?
Usually, the first pass is just sort of it's me reading it by myself, and then, you know, I usually like to get a hard copy of the script, and I take notes as I'm reading through, and stuff that pops into my head, images, usually, you know, I'm writing off to the side. Once I get through sort of that first pass, then I usually go in with the director and sit down and start discussing, you know, what their vision of the script is, and then just, you know, try to come together on, you know, in a very short amount of time, you know, the look that we're both going to attempt to create and try to augment, you know, their vision of what they want their episode to be. And then from there, we sort of, you know, there's all the other departments, you know, we try to strategically go in and, you know, go into the art department and talk to them, you know, if there's a big set piece that needs to be created, whether they feel that we can, you know, build it in the studio, or if there's a place somewhere in Vancouver that that we can use that might be, you know, a little more shoot friendly, you know, start with that. And then, you know, there's the first trip out of the studio usually is to find the biggest locations that we have to deal with on that that episode. And then after that, you know, then there's what's involved with those scenes, whether there's a lot of stunts involved, whether there's a lot of effects involved, or a combo of both of those. And we start adding that stuff into the mix about how we're going to attack, you know, the visuals for that episode.
When you attack in go crazy mode, as you said, what does it look like for us?
Well, it depends on the time period, and it really depends. I mean, it's, you know, the visuals of the show for me, and it doesn't matter whether it's this show or other shows that I've done, usually starts with the screenplay and you know, starts with what's on the written page. And from that, we're, you know, I feel like we're trying to tell the story that, you know, Mark and Phil have, and the writer's room have come up with. And, you know, we're trying to create, you know, the, I don't know if correct is the right word, but an image that will translate the emotion from that scene, and something that's stunning, but something that works within that scene and that the story that we're telling, something that you will look, you know, hopefully you're going to look at and you're going to feel, you know, the emotion from the scene, but it's not something that will jump out at you. You might think it's a great image, but it works within the story. And that's, for me, that's my main goal, is, you know, creating an image that works within that.
You were saying before we came on that the tone of the program has changed from the first season, which happened this winter and spring, to the second season, which you're now midway through. What was the tone that changed, and how has that affected your work or the way the show is photographed?
The show's a little bit more lighter. It's, you know, there's a few more jokes, I guess, in it. It's a bit more sort of, you know, in points, there's a bit more sort of Ocean 11 kind of fast pace action, but the, you know, there's some, a little more comedy sort of thrown into it. So the, what we try and do on the show is, I guess, is a bit more of a cinematic approach to covering a scene where you don't have to go in and do sort of traditional, you know, a master shot overs and then close-ups of everybody in the scene. Sometimes logistically it's just not possible with the amount of time that we have. Like sometimes I've had episodes this season where we've had 12 actors in a scene, and what we've tried to do is keep the camera moving and, you know, try to do sort of start the scene off with two actors and have them walk in and then hand off to the next two that are talking and then hand off to the next two, as opposed to breaking it down into more of an edited program, which I guess is a bit more, you know, sort of older traditional what TV was, and now it's sort of morphing into what you can get away with on TV now is a lot more cinematic, and the audience members, I think, are, you know, they enjoy it, and the fan base, I think, you know, they seem to like it from the reviews that I've seen on YouTube and read.
DC's Legends of Tomorrow on the CW continues its second season Tuesday, January 24th at 9 p.m. It is moving to Tuesday nights right after The Flash, an hour earlier. That's 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. And we're speaking live from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, with the director of photography of the series, Marlon Todd Williams. He's here with us this half hour live on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum, who's live from New York, live here with us on this holiday week. Happy Hanukkah, happy Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. Later on in the week, if you have a question or comment for Mail On, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple049. We got a big 90-minute episode coming your way on Friday, and we will kick it off with Helen Thomas, the Chief Executive Officer of TouchJet, which last week finally started selling its unique touchscreen television equipment. A way you can get smartphone or tablet apps, Android-powered, on your television set and actually use them by putting your fingers and manipulating the screen. Helen Thomas, who was with us a year ago, will be back with us as our lead guest on Friday. And then we'll go live to Paris and we'll speak with the former writer, producer of The X-Files, and producer of The Man in the High Castle, Frank Spotnitz. His latest work premieres New Year's Night, Ransom, on CBS. And finally, we will have a new player in the world of smart TV sets and devices and software. The player is called Vumo. We'll meet with the leader of that company, Colin Petrie-Norris. It's all coming up on the 90-minute edition of Tomorrow We Televise to kick off your Christmas holiday weekend at 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, this Friday, live on Tomorrow We'll Be Televised. How long did it take Mailon to do an episode of Legends of Tomorrow? How is it different, let's say, from other shows that are around, let's say, that shoot in Vancouver?
What's our shooting schedule?
Yeah, like a typical episode from first shot to last on an episode.
Well, the main unit is shot in 8 days, and then the day after we wrap main unit, we go into a crossover day. So the director and I roll into a second unit day while the rest of the crew goes back to the main unit with the new director and Dave Geddes, who's the alternating DP with me on the series. So 9 days is what we have. So that's, you have 9 days to prep a show and then 9 days to shoot a show.
I'm noticing that on a lot of the superhero series, whether it's your program or Gotham on Fox, et cetera, and Gotham had a screening of a recent episode here in New York that was sponsored by the Mayor's Office of Media Entertainment, that we're seeing a lot of two-unit deals where you have one unit doing an episode, a second unit preparing another episode, and trying to sort of make the production schedules work. Is that just the case with not just your show, but a lot of superhero shows or a lot of the programs that are shot in Vancouver and other places in Canada?
It's sort of the template for the – definitely for the Berlanti productions, and I'm pretty sure that most of the other superhero shows are – have to sort of follow suit. The shows are so big that when it comes to, you know, helping design the look of the episode, it would be crazy and super hard to do that if you weren't working in prep with the director. If you were shooting an episode and then you just rolled on to the next episode as the DP, with, you know, with the director without having a lot of that time to sit down and talk about what you're going to do, figure out, you know, the technical issues, and then just, you know, come up with a visual look to the show. It'd be very hard. And I, all of the Berlanti shows, Supergirl, Flash, Arrow, they've got two alternating DPs on them. And that's exactly what happens, is one is shooting while the other one is prepping.
And the Greg we're talking about is Greg Berlanti. He is the executive producer on many of those shows, on the CW, other places as well. And he has a hot streak going in terms of adapting DC material for television. Talk about how you were able to get the role as director of photography. I understand that before this you had done some made-for-TV movies, and you also worked on two series on sci-fi. One was Alphas, which ran for a couple of seasons with a wonderful actor named Malik Yoba in the cast. And you also did a comic book adaptation, too.
I did. I worked on Painkiller Jane about 10 years ago, which is based on a comic book. And yeah, I did all 22 episodes. It lasted for the one season. It was a great experience, a super busy show. We shot 18 of the episodes here in Vancouver, and then the producers wanted us to go to Budapest to finish the final four episodes, which was... It's the first time I'd ever worked over there. We had a great crew here, and we were very lucky to get an awesome crew when we landed in Budapest. It was fairly busy over there at the time too, and they had they got us a crew that were pretty stellar over there, and we got access to a lot of fantastic locations that we wouldn't have in Vancouver. You know, we were out in the middle of Budapest on city streets and shooting in 300-year-old castles and all this fantastic stuff. Plus we were there in the middle of their summertime too, which, you know, if you're going to hang out in that city, that was a great time to do it.
So from there, and the movies the week that you did in Alphas, how did you get the role with Legends of Tomorrow? What did Greg and his fellow creators think about your work and said, okay, mail on, let's bring you aboard?
My reel had been sent down to Greg, and it was through Dave Geddes, who's the other cinematographer. Dave got the job originally, and then we're both based here in Vancouver, and Dave had got my name and my demo reel and contacted me and asked if I was interested in doing the show and alternating with him. And I don't know all the meetings that my demo reel was in down south, but I'm sure there was a few and some discussions. And Mark and Phil, who are the two main producers on our show, had seen it and gave me the thumbs up. And I was on board in, I think it was the end of June of last year. And I came in to basically prep even before I was supposed to on the show, it was such a big show that I just wanted to get my head around it. So while Dave was prepping, I ended up sort of shadowing him on a few of the meetings just to get it, you know, find out how they were going to tackle the effects and the stunt portion of the show before I had to get into my episode.
Mm-hmm. What is it like for you to run the show as far as the look of the series is? And also, do you have any, you know, role models, whether it is director of photography for television or for film, that you see as inspiration for what you do?
Inspiration-wise, there's a million guys out there. It's a mix of, you know, there's some stuff I've seen in music videos. There's some stuff I've seen in features. You know, there's, you know, class, you know, Conrad Hall, you know, people like that. I've been, you know, a super fan of since, you know, I started out in film school. I got to work on, when I was an assistant in town here, I got to work on a couple of commercials with John Toll and got to see how he worked, you know, actually in person. And Tom Siegel, I did a couple of commercials as an assistant with and got to watch him work on set. Plus, you know, I had stacks of DVDs of, you know, movies that I loved. Elliot Davis's stuff. He did Out of Sight with Steven Soderbergh, which is one of my favorites. And I got to work with him as a camera assistant on a couple of commercials. You know, so there's stuff from that. There's, you know, still photographer work that I've seen. A lot of, you know, war correspondent photography. You know, I loved, you know, a lot of the frames guys were coming back with, you know, from actual events. And just looking into the history of, you know, some of the photographers that cinematographers that I followed, they, you know, a lot of those guys started out doing documentary work, and that's some of the first jobs that I got as a cinematographer was documentary, and, you know, learned how to deal with a lot of natural light and location work based on shooting that.
We're speaking with Malon Todd Williams. He's director of photographer on DC's Legends of Tomorrow. It will be coming back for its second season on January 24th, 9:30 Pacific Time, right after The Flash. That's Tuesday night on the CW. And Malon is with us live from Vancouver, Canada, this half hour on Tamabi Televised. Happy you're with us on this pre-holiday week, whatever holiday you're celebrating, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, etc. Simon Appleband with you live from New York. If you have a question or a comment for Malon, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next week, special schedule. We'll be with you next Wednesday and next Friday. That's Wednesday and Friday, December 28th and 30th, regular time, 3:30 Eastern, New Pacific, here on Tamabi Televised. And the following week, right after the New Year's Eve, New Year's Day holiday period, we'll be with you on January 3rd and 6th. Tuesday, Friday. So next week is Wednesday, Friday. Following week, Tuesday, Friday. Same hour, 3:30 Eastern, New Pacific, here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. It's very clear that in this era of what some call peak TV, the new golden planet age of television, that shows have become more cinematic. What do you think they have, Malon? Is it because of high-definition television and what you can do with it with a wider picture? Is it because of just trying to be different from other folks? What do you think is responsible for that?
Well, I think it's a combo of it, and I think it's also that the audience for a lot of these shows are, you know, willing to watch a show that's, you know, in a letterbox format, you know, and, you know, the lighting styles, you know, have changed a fair amount. You can get away with doing, you know, a lot of darker stuff, a lot of, you know, you can use a lot more color than a lot of shows were able to get away with a few years ago. And, you know, I think it would be fantastic to be able to actually shoot something anamorphic and have it broadcast anamorphic. But a lot of that hurdle still, there's a few shows I think that have been able to get away with it. And the fact that Netflix and Amazon and Crackle are now sort of getting into the mix, they seem to have opened the door a little further about what you're allowed to do. You know, presenting your story visually.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Conrad Hall before, and one of his big breaks was the Outer Limits, the first season, where he did a lot of unique shots where he would look up at the character was sort of out of focus, in focus, in different places. And you look at a show like Mr. Robot, what Tom Campbell was doing in that show, where the main characters are on the side of the picture, not right center in. Or you look at a show like Eyewitness, also on USA Network, which just wrapped up last night, where the show is more black and white, or the color is so muted it looks black and white. It seems that everybody's taking more chances as part of raising the creative bar to try things like, let's shoot more black and white, let's not shoot straight color, let's have characters in like very unusual places on the screen.
For sure they are, and it's, you know, there's a lot of content out there, and there's a lot of, you know, choices for an audience to go and check out, and, you know, for you to have your work stand out, and, you know, being able to take those chances as, you know, has opened the door to, you know, a lot of different stuff visually and telling stories differently. So, you know, hopefully that trend will continue and allow us to, you know, to push the limits as far as we can.
Before we let you go, Malon, many TV series are on many TV series. Being a cinematographer or being the director of photography sometimes can be a stepping stone to being a director. Law and Order and its spinoff series for years has sort of served as a platform. Ernest Dickerson's Spike Lee cinematographer on film was the original cinematographer on Law and Order. Now he's directing all over the place, including The Walking Dead. His replacement, Constantine Makris, now is a director on Law and Order SVU. His replacement, Christopher Mizano, has become a director on a lot of series. Michael Slovis, the wonderful cinematographer on Breaking Bad, is now directing SVU. Any thoughts that maybe down the road you might want to direct a Legends episode and sort of graduate?
Yeah, I think it would be a fantastic show to be able to make that leap. It's the Berlanti Group is you know, very accommodating with, you know, giving cinematographers a chance to direct. Dave Geddes has directed two episodes of the show and of Legends, and I know that you know, Flash and Arrow, their cinematographers have also been able to do episodes of the show. And for me, you know, the show's got such a an awesome look, and just like I said, with the different time periods, it would be a fantastic place to you know, get my break to be able to do that.
Well, you never know. You got another season, a half a season to go. And that half season of Legends of Tomorrow, that's right. And that half season of Legends of Tomorrow, part of season two, second half, begins on January 24th. It's a Tuesday night right after the Flash on the CW. That's 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Flash starts an hour earlier. Check your local list where the CW is available on a broadcast station area. For more details about the program and the network online, here's where you go. www.cwtv.com. That's www.cwtv.com. Once again, DC Legends of Tomorrow, second half of season two, begins January 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right after the Flash on the CW. Malon, Todd Williams, thank you again for joining us. A pleasure to have you. Congratulations to you and your crew on the second season. Have a wonderful holiday season and a great second half, and a whole lot more coming. Hopefully many more seasons of the show to come.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. Thanks for having me.
It has been a pleasure all the way, Malon. Take care. Again, happy holidays.
Awesome. Happy holidays, too.
You. Malon, Todd Williams, joining us live from Vancouver, Columbia, director of photography on DC's Legends of Tomorrow. Our commentary question and more on tomorrow's televised coming your way, but first, a few thoughts on the fine people at Audible.com. Are you a fan of Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show? Well, you may not know it, but Trevor Noah has done some audio work as well as video, and one of his works is a wonderful tale called Born a Crime. It's actually classic short stories that Noah got involved with while he was growing up in South Africa. And you can hear those wonderful stories for yourself as part of a wonderful trial offer to Audible.com. Audible.com is a great digital sound experience. You can choose from over 180,000 titles of every category around and then some. And you can listen to any of those titles on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. Remember, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, that's audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook, whether it's Trevor Noah, Born a Crime, or anything else, and you get a 30-day trial of the service. Remember, because Audible is owned by Amazon.com, the customer service is incredibly great. So, give it a try, and hear for yourself why great digital sound can be inspiring, informational, and certainly entertaining, whether Trevor Noah or many of the other wonderful titles available to you 24/7. AudibleTrial.com/televised. AudibleTrial.com/televised. Check out Audible.com. It's a great sound experience. Now time for our Craft Trivia Question of the Week. If you're first with the correct answer, you can win the wonderful book, Britcoms, FAQ from Applause. Twin Peaks is coming back in its wonderful revival state on Showtime next year, and our question deals with, by the way, it's our last Classic Trivia Question of the Year, so make it work. Here's the question. In what state did Twin Peaks locate? Or in which state did Twin Peaks locate? So, or what state did or is Twin Peaks located? Let's say it again. In what state or which state is Twin Peaks located? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and your mailing address. You can also use Twitter to get the answer in. Use this hashtag, TWET, the Twitter hashtag TWET. Once again, great thank you to Marty Monaco and the wonderful crew at Hopscotch for making it happen. Don't forget, Hopscotch is the way you can create your own social soundtrack all year long and beyond. So check it out at hopscotch.com and use Twitter if you like. get your answer. Remember, first correct answer will win BrickCom FAQ from Applause, Books, and Cinema. If you just came in and missed the question, no problem. I'll post it tomorrow morning on my Facebook page and my own Twitter hashtag at UBC Simon CWBT. That's UBC Simon CWBT. But remember, you got to be in to win. So get involved and all the very best. When we come back, Spanish language TV executive and expert Court Stroud joins me here in New York to discuss where Spanish language TV is going next year and beyond. We will get to that, plus another segment on two guests that were supposed to be on Friday's episode. One did, one didn't. And for the one that did, we have a very special breaking news story. We'll get to that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are listening to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for Sitting Around Talking Movies, the wonderful movie review show hosted by New York One's Neil Rosen and Bill McCuddy. Catch it every week right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best to BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half of Marvin Televised for this pre-Christmas week Monday. Simon Applebaum, we do live from New York. Whatever holiday you're celebrating at the end of the week, whether it's Christmas or Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, etc., it's all coming together this year, all in the same time period. We thank you for tuning us in and making us part of the week. Another great guest coming your way this half hour, plus an up segment two. So if you have a question or comment, get the ring in at 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And Rick Webber, Frank from Philadelphia, is already in the room. This has definitely been a big year for Spanish language TV, all sorts of things happening, and here to talk about that and where the medium is going next year is someone who's been on the inside and the outside of that medium, former Spanish language TV executive, also an expert on the subject, and now the managing director of his own organization, the Quito Group. It's a pleasure to welcome this program for the very first time here in New York, Court Stroud. Court, happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you too, Simon, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. What do you think was the big Spanish language TV development this year?
Hands down, it's the progress that Telemundo has made in terms of its primetime ratings. For the season to date, ending the week of December 11th, Telemundo for adults 18 to 49, according to Nielsen, is at 870,000. Univision is at 830,000. That is a tremor that has turned into an earthquake. What began last summer with a new programming strategy from Telemundo, launching three new shows in the same night, has proven very successful. And Telemundo's unthroning of Univision as the top-rated primetime network is undoubtedly the biggest story of 2016.
Also, this was the year where both Telemundo and its sister network, NBC Universo, mixed up the format a little bit. In the case of NBC Universo, they tried original drama, El Vato. Both of them, for the first time, did primetime coverage of the Summer Olympics in Rio, although not every night, but they did at least something, and that was the first time anyone that's happened. We were seeing what's called, I mentioned the tease, the bio-musical, like Celia and the Juan Gabriel series, where we're seeing the telenovela try this idea of musical drama. An iconic artist like a Celia Cruz, or I understand Univision's, or someone's going to do something on Jenny Rivera, the late Hispanic music star. It does seem to the sense that people are willing more than ever before to try new formats and to try weekly dramas, to try a different type of telenovela. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think we have to look at and define the audience that we're discussing, and everything you've said is about the U.S. Hispanic audience. And I think that this is true to some degree in other markets, but particularly in the United States, you've got a growing segment of the marketplace that may be choosing English language programming or Spanish language programming. And because of that, the expectations for Spanish language programming in this country have changed. The novela, the strip format of Monday through Friday, the same show, you know, at 7 and 8 and at 9, or depending on your part of the country, from 8, 9 to 10, has changed. And so the expectations have changed, and the willingness to do a weekly, to tune into a weekly series has grown significantly. And what's happened is the U.S. has traditionally not been a huge producer of Spanish language content, the Hollywood of Spanish language programming really being more Mexico City. What's happened is when Telemundo made a decision, a strategic decision, to take control of its own destiny and start producing its own content, whether it's produced in Miami or in other places, what that's done is it's allowed for greater freedom to try new formats or to try things to shake things up. And so it's allowed Telemundo to offer the audience the opportunity to see things that may remind them more of English language television in the U.S. than Spanish language television. And that, I think, has been a significant development in the marketplace. But, for example, the Celia Cruz program that you mentioned, as well as the Juan Gabriel, those are actually both Sony productions that are co-productions with Telemundo and with TV Azteca. And so there is an international impact in those kind of formats, even if we're specifically talking about the U.S.
At the same time, because there's also seems to be more Spanish language unscripted programming of different kinds. You have a network like Estrella TV, which produces all of its content in the U.S., specifically L.A., which does a nightly talent show, a late-night comedy kind of sketch comedy show at 10 o'clock. You have a Azteca America, there's a game show hour at 7 p.m. with different game shows every night under an umbrella title, and is doing a different kind of reality with some dramatic aspects to it. And it seems that those shows are starting to get some traction. And I'm wondering what you think about the unscripted side of Spanish language TV and what kind of progress. And let's not forget Discovery en Español and a number of other networks. And I'm curious to see, and you worked at Azteca TV for a while, what do you see as sort of like the unscripted side of, or the non-dramatic or non-scripted side of the medium?
So I did work for Azteca America, a subsidiary of TV Azteca. And one of the things I think it's important to keep in mind is unscripted television in Spanish in this country isn't brand new. Actually, there's a program called La Academia, The Academy. It's a Mexican reality music talent show. It began in June of 2002 on TV Azteca and in Azteca America here in the U.S. So the idea of unscripted is not something that's brand new. I would agree with you that we're seeing more of it, whether we're talking about the productions for Estrella or from Azteca or from, you know, Univision's La Banda. There is definitely more of it, but that's a trend that's a worldwide trend and not specifically limited to the U.S. Hispanic marketplace.
One of the big things why Ovato was being looked at with a lot of attention was that one of the long-running concerns of Spanish language TV by critics is not enough is done in the United States. We don't have U.S. writers. We don't have U.S. Hispanic directors, et cetera, and stars involved with Spanish language television because a lot of the shows are produced by Televisa in Mexico or whoever in Puerto Rico or whoever TV in Spain or TV Globo in Brazil, all of which have a lot of interesting degrees of quality. So one of the things about Ovato was here's a show that's mostly produced in the U.S. with U.S. talent, with U.S. writers, with U.S. directors, and so on and so forth. Do you see in 2017 that there is going to be more opportunity for scripted television, whether it is the telenovela format, which Telemundo has been a big believer in, doing shows out of Miami, Bajo Mismo Cielo in Los Angeles, which dealt with the whole issue of immigration? Do you see that 2017 could be a breakout year in terms of a lot of these networks trying, even Univision, trying to do more programming based in the U.S. that is U.S. themed, that's more relevant culturally and production-wise with the United States?
So it's a great question and one that has been discussed for decades now here in the U.S. Hispanic television marketplace. But let me take a step back. One thing I think it's important to know is, you know, in terms of the quality, Globo Television, the Brazilian broadcaster, produces absolutely stunningly beautiful programming. The programming that comes from Montana Tres, for example, or comes from TV Azteca, that comes from Televisa, is a little bit different, but the quality can be very, very high. So Televisa has made a specific design to have lighting that can appear somewhat cheesy, for the lack of a better word, and that has a specific reason behind it. It's not from a lack of knowledge of the look and feel. The reason I bring this up is the model for creating content in the U.S. for U.S. Hispanics doesn't fit the current business model very easily for Spanish language television. The model has traditionally been get programming from abroad that is not very expensive and then to air it in the U.S. And that was one to design to make people who might choose, whether for necessity or for just simple preference, to be able to see programming in Spanish. What happens is the moment you start relying on heavily on U.S. productions, the cost, the margins go down, the costs go up. It's very expensive to produce in the United States, even in Miami. There are union issues in certain states. There are issues in terms of just the simple productions can be much more expensive. So I think that that's an important first thing to analyze before thinking that, you know, lots of companies are going to start producing for the U.S. Hispanic market, specifically in this country. It breaks the model. And Telemundo has been able to do that. Fortunately, they have, fortunately for them, they've got in the NBCU parent a company that is willing to invest heavily into new content with the hope that they can then become a content exporter. Univision has produced content in the U.S. Like a Sábado Gigante in the past, but in general has relied heavily on the, and so has Azteca, in general because it's very expensive to produce in this country. And so I would caution that I wouldn't expect to see in 2017 an explosion of content produced in the U.S. for the U.S. Hispanic marketplace. One of the reasons, too, is if it's produced for the U.S. Hispanic marketplace, it may not play well. It might, and it might not play well abroad. So, for example, some of the Telemundo shows are in 100% Spanish and have done well in the international markets. But a show that is produced in English then may become very difficult to sell to Mexico or Colombia or Argentina. So I think that we may see more of an interest in that, but I don't think that we're going to see an explosion of new content in English, for example, for the U.S. Hispanic marketplace produced by the traditional Spanish language television companies.
Yeah. One other thing before we move on, Walt Disney has done some experimentation. At one point, they did a version of Desperate Housewives in Spanish, and it did not work. And maybe some of the thinking was, hey, they were doing it overseas. Why couldn't they do it on their back lot in Los Angeles where they shoot the current show? The other thing is, I wonder, like, where is Warner Brothers and Lionsgate, which has a deal with Televisa, by the way, to produce English language shows under a special production deal, and has also a Spanish language film division, which has been very successful with movies in Spanish. Where are all the key production companies at in terms of trying to produce this marketplace, which keeps on growing? Let's remember, the Hispanic population is now nearing 60 million, and if the research and the data is intact, maybe the next couple of decades could surpass 100 million people.
So, I mean, I think it's important, you're mentioning about Disney's production of Devious Maids, but it's important to understand that's actually a U.S. production of a Televisa novela, and it was co-produced with Televisa USA.
I wasn't meant Devious Maids. I know that's a different thing with Lifetime. I was talking about Desperate Housewives, because they have Desperate Housewives. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay, the Desperate. I'm sorry. You're right, which aired on Univision. I don't know that. Okay, I think there's a couple things factoring. So it sounds like your question is, when are the big Hollywood studios going to break into producing Spanish or content for the U.S. Hispanic market? Is that correct?
Yes.
So my feeling is that there's a couple of drivers affecting their entrance. One, the companies by and large have made efforts to understand the U.S. Hispanic market by bringing in multicultural talent, not just the U.S. Hispanic market, but also the African-American, Asian-American. So they've made an effort to try to bring in executives that understand that. But by and large, we're still seeing a lack of diversity in terms of the script writers, directors, producers, the people behind the scenes. And so while there might be a Hispanic character that's featured in product coming from Hollywood, by and large, we're not seeing, outside of Robert Rodriguez, which is the exception that sort of produce that shows the rule, you know, we're not seeing a lot of content specifically geared towards the U.S. Hispanic marketplace because the companies themselves don't have that expertise. I think another thing that's going in is that there's, besides the lack of expertise, is it's a market that may seem foreign and scary, even if it is for U.S. Hispanics. But what I can tell you is that the Hollywood studios really are starting to understand that U.S. Hispanics are absolutely essential, for example, in the theatrical releases. And so that's, I think, setting the stage for more involvement from the Hollywood studios to do co-productions like the one that I referenced with Devious Maids, They're trying to figure out how do they reach U.S. Hispanics and the broader market with stories that resonate with U.S. Latinos.
We're speaking with Court Stroud. He is the managing director of the Cleta Group. He is also a former Spanish language television executive, and he's with us live here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Great to have him aboard, and you aboard as well through Blog Talk Radio. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York, where it's 27 degrees outside. We're back in the polar wave, but not for long. It's supposed to get up to the 40s and 50s by the time we hit Christmas Eve. If you have a question or a comment for Court, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, my name. Again, coming up on show Friday, 90-minute edition. First, touchscreen television is finally here with TouchJet Wave, and we will have our chart visit from the person who's making it happen, the chief executive of TouchJet, Helen Thomas. Then, live from Paris, Frank Spinas, the former X-Riders Wider producer, also involved with The Man in the High Castle. His latest work is Ransom, the series New Year's Night on CBS. And we will have from Zumo, a new player in the world of smart TV sets, devices and software. We have the chief executive officer of that company, Colin Petrie Norris. All Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. What do you see, Court, as major breakthroughs for next year with Spanish language TV, taking the whole picture in?
So I think the biggest question hanging over the industry is what's going to happen with Univision? Univision was purchased as part of a leverage buyout, has a massive debt load hanging over, lost an estimated $30 million in third quarter, laid off 6% of its workforce, 250 people, and is facing the question, when are they going to have their IPO, or when will there be an answer from the FCC? Just to back up a second, the FCC has been petitioned by Univision and Televisa to allow for foreign ownership up to 40% of the network. And that would allow some convertible debt to be turned into shares so that Televisa would, in essence, be a majority shareholder in the company. Saban, one of the primary shareholders in Univision, was a very vocal, probably the most vocal supporter of Hillary Clinton in the media. And Univision has a contentious relationship with the president-elect Trump. So given that the FCC has now lost two of its Democratic members, well, they lost one that was not re-upped, and then Tom Wheeler has said he's going to resign. It does not look that is going to be decided upon before the inauguration, which means it's basically hanging. No one knows what the Trump administration will do or will suggest to the FCC with regards to this. If they allow it, it may give Univision some breathing room to start to invest in programming and become more competitive on a ratings basis with Telemundo. If it doesn't happen, I think all bets are off, and it's hard to know what's going to happen with Univision. Will it continue to slide? You know, there's some questions about the methodology that Nielsen using. Is it penalizing Univision to a greater degree than Telemundo, for example? Basically, can we trust that the ratings that we're currently seeing are correct or not? Univision has lost about 2 million people on average nightly, and that's a huge drop that really defies explanation. And I personally question if there isn't something wrong for have such a huge loss so quickly. But I think that's the biggest question. What will happen with Univision? And then that will lead to what will happen between Univision and Telemundo. Will Telemundo continue to lead in the marketplace in prime time, or will Univision be able to come back?
One thing I also wonder is whether we're going to see more attempts at bilingual or English language programming aimed at Latinos from the Spanish language TV players. Univision, of course, is involved with Fusion. They're involved with Robert Riggs' El Rey Network as a minority investor. I mentioned El Vato, which sometimes has bilingual scenes in their program. They're going back for a second season next year on NBC Universo. You wonder whether we're going to see how much more we're going to see in terms of efforts to try to broaden out the Spanish language base into really a full-fledged Latino television universe of Spanish language, bilingual, English language programming.
So I doubt that we see a huge movement in that direction in 2017. Here's why. CTV, oh gosh, about 10 years ago, tried to do that, became Nuvo, brought in Jennifer Lopez, and ended up basically becoming Fusion, basically a music channel. Why? they struggled with making that successful. The quarterly reports from UCI shows that both Fuse is what I was talking about before. Fusion was the joint venture with ABC and with Univision. ABC walked away from it. That's really struggling. And I suspect that it's going to be difficult to convince the companies to invest heavily in bilingual programming when there's some really strong examples of failure or struggles from El Rey, Fusion, and Nuevo TV in that English language for Latinos or bilingual market.
Talk about what Cleto or your group is doing. Are you doing television ventures? Are you focusing on other aspects of the medium? What is the focus of your new enterprise?
Sure. So the Cleto Group is a boutique consultancy firm that specializes in media, entertainment, and storytelling, with an emphasis on content marketing for brands and for agencies that are looking at that. I work with a number of clients in the media and entertainment space, helping them understand the media landscape in general and Hispanic in particular. Sometimes it's over the overall market. Sometimes it's specifically about the Hispanic market. And then also advising on strategies for content marketing and particularly digital first content about what is a market looking for, what could be successful, and how to reach young people in particular, but basically everybody with cool digital first content.
Before I let you go, Court, let's talk about the wider diversity picture. One of the big developments, I think, this year was in the wake of the Oscars, when there were very few actors of color nominated and little else. We've seen the growth of or the development of all these different ventures, from the Alice Institute to We for She, We Did It Together, Project Her, Presenting Women, couple of projects from the Mayor's Office of Media Entertainment, all designed to bring more women of color, people of color, women into television as creators, writers, directors of their own series. And we're seeing that more with the TV festivals. Sundance and Tribeca are spending more into television. They've got an Epitaph Television Lab that's largely diverse. Where do you see diversity in television, or some would say inclusion of television, going next year generally?
So, there has definitely been a trend towards diversity and inclusiveness in media that has been going on for some time, and certainly culminated with Oscars So White and then the response to that. I think that it's too early to say absolutely that it's going to continue. Under the new political climate, there are plenty of people that I know who are saying this is now going to be stifled to some degree. I know other people who say, no, diversity is a trend towards equality, whether we're talking about African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American, LGBT, disabled voices, to bring in a variety of viewpoints. I fall someplace in between. I think that there will continue to be an emphasis on diversity and reaching out, because ultimately it's good business. But I think that there's going to be some trepidation on the part of those in power because of the current political climate to automatically say we're going to have a diverse cast, for example, or that we're going to take a chance on diverse people behind the camera. It remains to be seen, but ultimately, because I do believe it is good business, that it will prevail, even if it's dampened in 2017, 2018.
Well, we will see if that does unfold this coming year and beyond, and we will continue to follow both the general effort about diversity and inclusion in the industry as well as the Spanish language TV effort. Cleto, if people want to catch what you're doing online, where can they go?
They can go to cletorgroup.com or certainly connect with me on LinkedIn. I do some writing, and it's in various places, so they can always check in on LinkedIn to be able to find that.
Great. Court, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. A very happy holiday season, and all the best in 2017 to you and your crew. We definitely want to have you back on next year.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon. Happy holidays to you and to all of your listeners. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Court. All the greatest. Take care. Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
Court Stroud, Managing Director of the Cleto Group, joining me here in New York. Before we leave you this Monday, it's time for... where we follow up on some of the guests and topics we've had in this program. And today we highlight two people that were scheduled to be on this program last Friday. One who did show up and one who didn't. The one who did show up was John Levin. He's the co-developer, executive producer, and sometimes writer of Shooter. That's a series that was postponed several times earlier this year on USA Network. Finally got off the ground this fall. It is on after WWE SmackDown Live Tuesday night at 10 o'clock. And at the time, Levin told us that the show was, despite the delays, getting a really good following. And there was a good, bright chance there could be a second season. Well, shortly after we left the air, Deadline Hollywood Daily, the popular entertainment news website, did its own piece about Shooter. And here's what they learned. 2.4, 2.5 million people watch Shooter every week on USA After SmackDown. And get this, it really has a following in Middle America. That region of the country has really discovered the show. Well, it is definitely perking up U.S. Network's ears because earlier this afternoon, before we went on the air, U.S. Network did announce Shooter is coming back for a second season. Yes, Shooter back for a second season next year on USA Network. The guest who was expected to be on the show and didn't show up was Lloyd Clark. He's director of product management at Roku, one of the top smart TV device makers. Well, we understand that he could not make it because of a change in schedule. We learned about that before we went on the air last Friday. Good news is we are rescheduling him for next month and next year, and we'll keep you posted when he will be on. And finally, remember the news that we gave you last week about that telethon Dolly Parton was organizing for victims of the wildfires in Tennessee and elsewhere in the South? Well, that special concert, which involved Reba McEntire and others, raised $9 million. And the $9 million telethon was carried on the Country Network, on RTTV, and we understand other cable channels as well. So congratulations to that effort, and it will do a lot of good for all the people impacted by those recent wildfires. Again, we're back with you on Friday, 90-minute edition, right before your Christmas Hanukkah weekend. Joining us will be TouchCheck's Chief Executive Officer, Helen Thomas, Mike Spotnitz of the new CBS series, Ransom, joining us live from Paris, and Colin Petrie-Norris, the Chief Executive Officer of Zubo. That's all 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tavavi Televised. If you came in on today's program, want to catch that episode you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version on iTunes.com, available 24/7. Download to your smartphone, tablet, take us on the go, share it with others. We'd love to hear from you. What do you have our hour today? What's your thoughts about where TV is at, Spanish language TV included, and where it's going? Let us know. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Why? Because what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Eddie Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager. The creator is Mr. Alan Levy. Tavavi Televised was brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. For Tavavi Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your Monday and week. Back with you on Friday, 90 minutes, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. That's where we get underway. You know where. Blog Talk Radio. Please be safe and be great out there. And until next time, stay well and stay tuned.